I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Is hair a material?
Are biscuits a material?
Are crystals a material?
Is plastic a material?
Is porridge a material?
Can gases be a material?
Are eggs a material?
Is water a material?
What do you call everything that isn't a material?
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at your question.
And yet you continue to do so.
Hello, and welcome back to Handmade, the making podcast with real talk about materials. I'm your host, Anna Pajewski, and this episode I talk to the guitar maker Tom Sands about wood. We sat down remotely, him in Yorkshire and me in London, and had this awesome conversation about handmaking guitars. I started by asking Tom how he got into guitar making in the first place.
Making things has just always been something that I've done. It's the classic story with most creatives and most makers. It's like there was never anything else, you know. So I started with woodworking. My grandfather was the kind of catalyst for me working with wood. Practical guy. We were always, anytime we were together, we were always mending, fixing, you know, doing something productive, doing something with our hands. And we used to love watching, I think it was like a PBS show, an American show called The New Yankee Workshop.
Okay.
Which was a guy called Norm Abram. Every episode he would make a reproduction of usually like shaker inspired furniture. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather and I would sit and watch this show like religiously. And he had quite a big workshop. He was like, well, we should try making some of this stuff, you know, instead of just sitting and watching it, we should do some stuff. And for my 15th, I think it was my 15th birthday, he gave me a radial arm saw, which is like an extremely aggressive power tool that you probably shouldn't be given to a 15-year-old. But anyway, so that my first kind of power tool was this like janky old radial arm saw. But we started making stuff, you know, like bits of furniture, and we made it all with this radial arm saw. And the bug like bit me hard. And slowly I started to accumulate more and more tools, you know, hand tools, mainly power tools. And we would build things together. And then around about when I was doing my A-levels at school, I was doing, you know, art and design and making furniture, all the kind of things that you do, art and design, clocks, like loads of little bits and pieces. And trying to come up with something to do for my final project. And while I was thinking, you know, I'm going to make a table or whatever else it might be, my best friend at the time, or still one of my very good friends, he wanted to make an electric bass guitar.
Okay.
And he kind of came to me and he's like, well, you know what you're doing with wood. I don't know what I'm doing with wood, but I know what I'm doing with a bass guitar. Mm. So I've got this proposition for you. How about you teach me or help me to figure out how to build a bass, and I'll teach you how to play.
Nice.
And so that was it. So it was like, okay, cool. That sounds like a good trade. And so over the next kind of 3 months or so, after school, at lunchtimes, you know, evenings and weekends, we were pottering around in my dad's garage with my radial arm saw and bits of wood and you know, just trying to figure this stuff out and having a really good time doing it. And at the end of 3 months, we'd successfully built this electric bass guitar, and we were just like completely thrilled, you know, kind of two 17-year-olds, just like, wow, we made this thing.
Yeah.
And for me, it was like, it's so illuminating, because I simultaneously discovered that you could make a musical instrument, and I, you know, found this new passion for playing as well.
Mm.
So then, I subsequently went to Glasgow School of Art to study product design, and found my way into the furniture making industry as a cabinet maker. And all the while I was kind of dabbling with instruments, that kind of never went away in the back of my brain. And so I was cabinet making for about 6 years. And then I kind of got to this point in my cabinet making career where, you know, I was building these beautiful objects, in going into really elaborate settings, you know, working in really state-of-the-art workshops. But I realized one day that my kind of love for the craft, you know, the reason that I got excited about woodworking in the first place, had kind of just been replaced by the 9-to-5 existence. You know, I'd go to work in the morning, a stack of drawings would appear on my bench, and I'd systematically work through them, and then I'd go home. And whilst I was doing great work and these really fantastic projects, the why had kind of fallen by the wayside. And so I decided that I needed to get my mojo back. And as I decided that I was going to go on a pilgrimage. And so I started to write to makers, artists and designers all over the world who were doing, you know, really cutting edge work, were right at the top of their field, wanting to go visit them. And one of the people that I contacted was a maker, a luthier, a guitar maker out in Oakland, California, a guy called Irvin Somogyi, who I always describe as the kind of the Gandalf of guitar making. He's like Yoda. Nice. He's, you know, he's, and he reinvented the kind of the steel string acoustic guitar, and has just been, you know, just on top of this golden podium of luthiery for decades. And so I wrote to him, and he graciously invited me out to go stay with him.
Amazing.
At the workshop. And I spent 2 weeks there with him, literally sleeping on the workshop floor, getting up at 6 a.m. every day, helping out around the shop, doing all these different like skills tests. And he was kind of putting the feelers out, kind of trying to get a sense of what I was about.
Yeah.
And at the end of that 2 weeks, he invited me to apprentice with him.
Amazing.
Which was kind of this really left field notion. But it was kind of like, well, I guess I'm just going to follow this. Like, why not?
Yeah.
You know? And then, so that was that. I moved to Oakland, kind of very, I felt like Tom Sawyer or something, you know. I kind of sold everything that I owned and just
nice.
Went.
How old were you across. At this point? Were you in your 20s at this point?
I was 28, 29.
Okay.
And yeah, so I moved across to the States with just, you know, a week's worth of clothes and some my kind of tool roll.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was it. So that was the kind of long-winded version of how I got into guitar making.
And so from there, so you apprenticed with him, and are you set up on your own now? How did that happen?
Yeah, so so I spent 2 years with Irvin, and it was like being a monk. You know, there was just no room for anything else.
Yeah.
You were in the workshop kind of all day, every day with the other apprentices, and just building guitars. It was a lifestyle. It was a way of life. You know, it was like, okay. And you know, not to mention the fact that I'd, you know, moved across, you know, an ocean to go and learn how to do this thing. And so I spent, 2 years. And slowly, you know, building guitars for Irvin, but also working on my own projects, and starting to put my own work out into the world, and starting to get a name for myself. And then, yeah, at the end of the 2 years, it was time for my visa expired. There was no chance of me getting another one. Mm. And so I moved back to the UK, set up my workshop, and started building guitars under my own name. And that was back in 2017. And the last kind of 3-4 years have been somewhat of a blur. But yeah, it's been pretty wild.
That's awesome. So you mentioned at the start you got into it through sort of woodworking, and that wood is like quite a crucial material in guitar making.
Yeah.
What woods do you use? What properties are you looking for? How do you go about sourcing the material?
Wow. So this is at the kind of the core of everything that I do. Well, and most makers, starting with the raw materials. Mm. And for guitar makers, we're always looking for what we call tone woods. So woods that have the capacity to make sound. And so that can be every species of wood responds to the input of energy differently. And so with the acoustic guitar, to put it really crudely and really simply, is an air pump, right? You've got an enclosed box with strings attached to it. You are driving those strings, which sets off in motion this kind of pumping action of the soundboard and the air column inside the sound box. And some woods will deal with that energy more efficiently than others. And some woods will want to absorb that energy. And all of this kind of acoustic dynamics that are going on contributes to different sounds. So traditionally, the finest guitars were made out of European spruce for the soundboard, things like rosewoods, Brazilian rosewood for the back and sides. We'd have things like mahogany, maple, koa from Hawaii, all these different woods with their own inherent musicality. Mm. Luthiers would kind of combine to generate a sound that they were hearing in their heads, or perhaps the client was hearing in their heads. I've just actually just started a new series on my YouTube channel called Tommy's Tonewoods.
Oh, amazing.
Where every day I pull a piece of wood out from the wood stash.
Yeah.
And we do this thing called tap testing, right? So I wish I had a piece of wood here with me, but basically you pinch the wood, hold it to your ear, and you tap it. The most lively pieces of wood will ring like a piece of glass,
really?
Or like they'll ring, they'll generate this kind of gong-like sound.
Really?
Oh yeah. It's really quite wild. So we do this with each piece of wood. We're listening for how it's responding to that input of energy, the tap. And as I was saying, some woods will really come alive and sparkle and chime like a bell, whereas other woods will kind of absorb that energy and kind of disperse it. Neither of which is better or worse. They just contribute to different tonal responses from the instrument. So anyway, so in Tommy's Tonewoods, every day I'm picking out a different piece of wood, talking about where it came from, why I like it, and doing a little tap test as well.
Amazing. So do you use all sorts of different personalities of wood in your work?
By personalities, do you mean like species? Or?
Well, yes. Yeah, species. And then I suppose, you were talking about the kind of variations in tone that you can get. Are there decisions that you have to make based on the material that you find in terms of where you will apply it to, or what shape of guitar you're planning on making?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, wood is just such a fabulous material. It's so variable, even within species. Mm. You can have... even from the same tree, even from the same board, two pieces of wood that are cut from the same tree will respond in totally different ways as a function of how the grain is, running through the board, whether there's run out, whether the grain is kind of wild, whether there's figure. And so for me, it's about it's so difficult talking about tone, talking about sound, trying to put adjectives to what you're hearing, right? Not to mention that everybody hears things differently. Mm. You know, the words that we choose to use don't always, they get lost in translation.
Sure, yeah.
And so for me, when I'm working with a client, it's about trying to understand, trying to build a shared vocabulary. So we're both singing from the same hymn sheet, as it were. So what I'll do is I'll start with usually using a guitar that I've made. You know, we'll try to analyze that instrument and say, okay, well, what are you hearing? What qualities of this sound appeal to you? Can you put words to this? And then maybe I'll put some words to it, and we'll try and figure out where we're both at and what we're hearing. And it's this kind of organic process of just sitting and listening to different guitars, playing, you know, whether that be in person or, you know, sharing clips via YouTube or email or whatever. And then I will start to kind of digest that and think, okay, well, for this type of sound, we'll maybe use some Sitka spruce from Alaska, and we'll pair that with, you know, some European walnut or something like this, to try and craft that sound. But it's always a bit of a surprise. You never know what you're going to get,
right?
You know, until you string the guitar up.
Yeah, the very end of the process.
Exactly. So it's always this kind of, you know, heart in the mouth moment. And then, you know, it's like, well, I can string a guitar up and play it for the first time, and you know, I might think it sounds great, but it's like, well, does this translate to what the client had in their head? And then you've got this added complexity as well, that as the wood, it takes quite a while for the wood to forget it's a tree and realize it's a guitar, you know.
Okay.
And so, because there's huge amounts of tension on guitar strings. And so it takes a little while for the guitar to settle in, to kind of relax into the find the equilibrium, the balance point. And as it's doing that, as it's relaxing and the tensions are kind of easing, and the sound of the guitar changes.
Interesting.
And it changes. You can from like hour to hour. You know,
no way.
Like overnight, it's amazing. You know, I'll string a guitar up for the first time, and quite often it sounds terrible. And I'll be like, oh no, what have I done? And then I'll kind of put it, I'll hang it up.
Yeah.
And I'll go away, and then I'll come back to it. And it's like, oh, okay. We're getting something here. Mm. And then you'll leave it overnight and you'll come back to it. And it's like a totally different, it's like, who came into the workshop in the night and tweaked this? So it's, they're really magical, kind of, it's like they're alive.
That's amazing. So my only reference point for this is I'm a trumpet player, and I interviewed for this podcast a trumpet maker, Andy Taylor. His process sounds quite similar to yours, in that he'll work with a client, he'll talk to them about what they want, you know, what their sound is like, listen to their sound, find out if they want to have their instrument help them reach a different kind of sound, be that, you know, higher playing or broader kind of more meaty sound or a brighter tone or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And then he will use materials and the kind of shaping of the trumpet in order to try and like meet those requirements. It seems like a fascinating mixture of like having to understand people and musicality and sound, and translating that into physical objects. But trumpets don't have the thing of it changing really throughout the lifetime. I would say I haven't noticed over the 20 years that I've had my trumpet, like any kind of shifting around of harmonics or, you know, once you've got the shape of the tube, that's the shape of the tube.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, you know, with wood, it expands and contracts. Mm. I mean, of course, metal does, but with wood, and it's also hydroscopic as well. You know, it's always taking up ambient moisture from the air. So I have to be really careful to work in a controlled environment. So I have hygrometers all around the workshop.
No
My
way.
Workshop is temperature controlled.
Yeah.
So I always know that the wood is stable while I'm while I'm building with it, because the last thing you want is to have a fluctuating climate environment. The wood moves around, you've glued things together, and all of a sudden it wants to fight itself. You know, you can run into problems with cracks and splits and glue delamination and all this kind of thing. So yeah, wood is a very unforgiving material.
Yeah, it sounds brutal. Because as well as all those things, like, it will be doing all that expanding and contracting and shifting around, like, in a different amount depending on the direction of the grain. And like you were saying, no grain is the same. And so every piece of wood is going to do a different thing. So you can't even develop a system of, well, I know that it needs to be this much bigger to compensate for that or whatever. It must just be, you really have to read the material underhand every time.
You absolutely do. And it's one of the beauties and the joys of working with wood is you never really know exactly what it's going to do. And also, you know, the wood has got to contribute to the sound of the instrument, obviously, but it's also got to look visually pleasing. And unfortunately, the most visually striking pieces of wood often are the ones with the wild grain,
right?
You know, that's refracting light in you know, different ways, because the grain is all going off at different angles, and you get all this like beautiful chatoyance.
What was that word? I don't know that. Chatoyance. What does that mean?
It's I'll probably misdefine it here, but it refers to how wood refracts light by differing degrees. And I would encourage people to go and look that up in the Oxford Dictionary, because the Tom Dictionary of chatoyance. But basically, if you think about, you know, when you mow the lawn, right, or you see like a football field on the TV and you get the stripes, right, as a function of, you know, some blades of grass laying at 45 degrees and the other laying in the opposite direction. It's bouncing light to different degrees, and you get, even though it's the same material, it's all grass, because of the way it's throwing the light, you're getting a different look. And obviously with wood, and when you move the wood around, if it bounces a light in different directions, and you get this kind of like flamey, ripply, you know, it looks like it's alive, it looks like it's moving. But whilst that's beautiful and very desirable, it doesn't always lend itself to behaving over the long term, you know, as a kind of structure.
Yeah.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
That was fascinating. It's amazing once you start thinking about a material that seems as everyday as wood, kind of the complexities in it and the sort of magic that is possible with it.
Yeah.
I appreciate that this is a very reductive question, but I would really love to hear what the process is of making a guitar. And I'm sure there are many, 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 many processes. But I guess, yeah, just like a summary of how you actually go about doing this.
Sure. Okay, so let's see. Where to start? The acoustic guitar is so infinitely complex. There are so many components. There are so many intersecting pieces of wood that are wanting to do different things. We're using lots of different species of wood all together to try and craft a sound. So for me personally, I offer three models, three different sizes of guitars. Mm-hmm. Different sizes of guitars respond in different ways, and ergonomically, they offer a different thing to the to the client. So for me, the first thing is to decide, well, what type of guitar am I going to build? What size? And then, as I said before, we started to think about, okay, what's the sound? What sound are we looking for? And so we start to select our materials. So we've decided the size of the guitar, we've decided what it's going to be made of. And then I like to think of the guitar in two kind of components. We've got the sound box, which is the curvy bit. Mm-hmm. And then we've got the neck, which you're holding onto with the left hand. So the neck and they are structurally separate, but ultimately get joined together. Mm. So the neck is the kind of primary interface between the player and the instrument. You know, it's what you're mostly in contact with. Mm. But the sound box is what's generating the sound, or what's amplifying the sound of the strings. And the sound box is split into three components. So we've got, or three main components. We've got the sides, which we call the rim, which wants to be a really stiff, solid construction. Much like you think about a snare drum, you know, it's made out of metal, it's very, very solid, which allows the energy from the strings to stay in the vibrating plates, which are the soundboard in the back of the guitar. What you don't want to happen is energy from the strings vibrating the soundboard, but then that energy has been sapped away by the sound, by the sides, which aren't producing any sound. So we want a rigid rim assembly. So that's the first thing we start with. You're creating the kind of the silhouette of the guitar. Then we'll take the soundboard, which is a book matched piece of usually spruce. So a piece of wood that has been cut, sawn down the middle. And then when you open it out, it's called open it like a book, book match. And then we'll join that together to get a piece of wood that is wide enough for a guitar soundboard, and it's also stable. Then we'll get into bracing the guitar. So the bracing is the internal structure. It's kind of like the joists in a ceiling. Mm. You know, you've got this very thin plate, this very thin piece of spruce, which needs to be thin so that it can vibrate and it can move. Yeah. But you need to balance that with some internal structure. So we have bracing on the inside of the guitar. Every luthier has their own bracing pattern, depending on how they want the guitar top to move and how they want the guitar top to respond, to depending on what sound they're looking for. So we'll brace the inside of the guitar. And similarly with the back. The back has different types of bracing, because the back is moving in a different way. Mm. It also doesn't have to withstand the pull of the strings. So once we've got that, once we've got the soundboard with the braces, we'll glue that to the rim, the silhouette of the guitar. And then we get into the kind of the magic, which is the voicing process, giving the guitar its voice. And this is the subtle kind of manipulation of the shape and size of the braces, the internal structure. And what we're trying to achieve is we want the guitar to have the guitar soundboard to be strong enough to resist the pull of the strings and not collapse. But we want it to be, it's this knife edge point. We want it to be flexible and supple enough that it can move and be really efficient with the energy that's been put into the system by the strings. So that is that's like the key to a great guitar is the kind of voicing process. You know, you are really trying to hit this knife edge point where it's, you know, it's not going to collapse, but mm-hmm. it's going to move and it's going to respond to the strings. So then we're going to glue the back on, so we've got a completed sound box. Then we do, you know, decorative elements like, you know, the rosette, which is around the sound hole. Mm. Each luthier has their own kind of take on what a guitar should look like.
Cool.
We've got the binding, which goes around the outside of the guitar just to give it some extra protection on the delicate edges of the instrument. Mm. And then we'll attach a neck, do all the kind of neck carving, all this kind of thing. And I like to, because my guitars are bespoke, each neck is designed to fit the player's hand perfectly.
Cool.
So I'll do things, you know, I'll measure the client's hand.
Yeah.
I'll take very precise measurements of the shape that the neck should be, how that tapers as it moves up towards the body, all this kind of thing. And then, you know, we'll do the kind of fret work, the finishing work. You know, my guitars are lacquered for protection, but also to make them look shiny.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's strings. And that in a nutshell is how to build a guitar.
And how long does that whole process take?
About 250 hours.
Oh my God. And is it just you, or do you have people working with you as well?
At the moment it's just me. I do have a new assistant who's going to be starting in September, I think.
Cool.
Which will kind of ease the load on me a little bit. But also stop me from going crazy, because it's a lonesome endeavor, you know, being a luthier. So it's going to be nice to have some company in the workshop besides the dog. She has quite the penchant for West African ebony. She's she knows a good piece of ebony when she finds it. And quite often I'll turn around and she's selected herself a nice fingerboard or something like this and putting her mark on it.
Oh dear. Yeah, perhaps not the best companion in a wood workshop.
Well.
So many tempting sticks.
Yeah, definitely. Expensive sticks. She has expensive taste.
So that was a beautiful summary of the guitar making process. And you mentioned quite a few points where there's a kind of magical transformation. For you, what's the most magical part of guitar making?
I think there's so many. I think the moment when the inanimate object has a voice and comes alive, you know, I think that's a really special moment. You know, it's like you know, meeting somebody for the first time, that kind of first hello, you know, when you first string a guitar up. But the magical thing for me, I think, is that you can hand a guitar to a different person and they will get sounds out of their guitar that nobody else can.
Mm.
And they will play that guitar in a way that, you know, is unique to them, and they will draw something out of that guitar that I, as the maker, didn't know existed.
Yeah.
Now, I remember the first trade show that I went to, it was the Holy Grail guitar show in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And, a player came up to my table, and I was very nervous because he was the first. It was my first trade show, and he was the first person to come to the table to try it. He wanted to try the guitar, and you know, I was like, "Oh, is he going to like it? What's he going to think of it?" And to make matters worse, he said, "Do you mind if I play with thumb picks?"
Okay.
So basically, and he had this little purse that he pulled out of his jacket, and he tipped out these finger picks onto his hand, and they were made of metal. And the idea is that you they're like surrogate fingernails.
Right.
Okay. So he was putting these brass, like sharp brass implements onto the end of his fingers and reaching for my guitar. And I'm thinking, brand new guitar, brand new shiny lacquer, plus metal. I was like, this is just scratch city waiting to happen. But, you know, I was like, well, I can't say no. Like, this is what I'm here for. Anyway, so I handed him the guitar, and he sat down, and it was right at the start of the show. So it hadn't really got busy yet. Mm-hmm. So the room was still quite quiet, and I could actually hear him playing. And he played this guitar and got these sounds out of it. And I was just like, this is just amazing. Mm. Like, I didn't know that my guitar could do that. And to see the look on his face and he really loved the instrument. Mm. That was a magical thing for me. You know, seeing the guitars in the hands of the people that they're designed for. Mm. You know, I work with a musician very closely, a guy called Will McNichol. He's a world-class guitar player. And the things that he can do with my instruments is just like, it just blows my mind.
Yeah.
And it just makes it so worthwhile, you know, to just hear the guitar doing the things that it's supposed to do. Mm. And then the other beautiful thing is just the relationships that come out of the whole process.
Yeah.
You know, it's, for me, you know, it can be 3 years between the first email coming in the inbox, you know, mm. making that first inquiry to me delivering the instrument.
Yeah.
You know, quite often I do that in person. I haven't been able to do this for the last year, obviously. Yeah. But this thing that I do has taken me all over the world, you know, meeting the most amazing people, staying with them in their homes, you know, and that those connections that have come about mm. through guitar making is, I never thought that would be the case, you know. It's yeah. that's been a really magical thing. And then, you know, it's like, you know, finding a really special piece of wood. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm forever looking through wood stacks at my local woodyard. I'm always on eBay trawling through the listings of, like, you know, I've got this piece of wood, I'm not sure what it is. And like, it's kind of like, you know, record collectors, they go digging, right?
Yeah.
You know, to find those like gems yeah. in the back of like a dusty Oxfam or something. Mm. It's a similar thing, you know, finding these pieces of wood and running your plane over them for the first time. Because of course, old pieces of wood, they oxidize, right? And the oxidation often masks the beauty of what's mm. underneath. And so this happened with my very first bass, that with my electric bass with my friend. We went to our local woodyard and we picked out what we thought was some black walnut, right? So like really dark, yeah. deep looking wood. It was beautiful. We're like, yeah, this is going to be great. We got it back to my workshop and planed into it, and it turned bright orange. like bright Donald Trump orange. And we were like, what? And it turned out to be a totally different species. It was African padauk,
oh, wow.
which is just this incredible orange.
Mm.
So those moments are really special, you know.
Yeah, surprises. Just like
full of surprises. Yeah.
And did you end up making the guitar out of that African padauk wood?
We did.
Oh,
yeah.
Back. Yeah. Oh, nice.
Yeah, yeah. So I've used that, and I've subsequently used, I've used it again to make acoustic guitars.
Oh, cool.
You know, which has been nice. You know, I had a chunk left over, which has just been sat for the last, you know, 15 years, reoxidizing, going brown again.
Yeah.
And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to use this and make it into an acoustic guitar. So nice. I had that I relived that memory all over again, which was really nice.
That's cool. For you personally, what are the next kind of frontiers in your practice? Do you have any unanswered questions or kind of difficulties that you haven't been able to overcome yet that you really want to crack?
That's a fantastic question. Yeah, there are so many avenues that I want to explore.
Yeah.
You know, as I was saying, the acoustic guitar is so complicated. There's so many parts. There's so many. I always feel like every luthier is trying to get more out of the instrument.
Mm.
And so there's two things that I'm thinking about right now is how can I use more... I don't know, like what construction methods can I borrow from other industries mm. and apply them to the acoustic guitar? You know, the acoustic guitar has remained pretty well unchanged for hundreds of years, mm. you know, right back to the early you know, guitar-like instruments, ouds, lutes, these kind of things. The construction has pretty much remained the same. So, you know, right now I'm doing a lot of investigation into composite materials, composite construction, you know, how I can make my guitars light, more lightweight, but still be really stiff and energy efficient. Mm. And then coupled with that, you know, the challenges that we face with sustainability, you know, traditionally the finest guitars have been made from Brazilian rosewood, which is a great sounding wood. It's also very beautiful, but it's like you can't get hold of it anymore. It's been over harvested, to the point where it's really heavily regulated. It's like trading with ivory, you know, you just can't, it's become so difficult to acquire, and rightly so, you know. And that's the case with lots of the kind of traditional, especially rosewood family materials. So the challenge is, well, how do I replicate, or how do I shift the paradigm around, because the guitar is so rooted in its own tradition, you know, people have expectations of what the best guitar should be made of and what the best guitar should sound like. So you've got to kind of shift perceptions of what woods you can and can't use in guitars, whilst also making a great sounding instrument that's going to last for 100 years and more.
Yeah.
So for me, I'm looking at lots of domestic hardwoods, and trying to craft a new narrative around those materials, finding materials with a story attached, you know, and really focusing on telling that story to get people excited beyond, you know, this is a beautiful piece of wood, you know, this is an expensive piece of wood, this is a rare piece of wood. It's, you know, this piece of wood was harvested. I work with a sawyer over in Hawaii. Hawaii is famous for its koa, acacia koa, which is this beautiful kind of orangey, stripy, brown, purple. It's just the most beautiful wood. But again, it's been over harvested, over exploited, and is, you know, becoming increasingly rare. But I've found a third generation sawyer, whose family has been managing forests, koa forests, for, you know, three generations. And he is somebody who's really passionate about the materials and conservation, and he only he only uses wood from dead trees, or trees that need to be cleared because they're diseased or something like this. And so whilst I'm still using an endangered, perhaps, I don't think it's endangered, but it's a material that's been over exploited, by kind of working with people who really know, understand, love and respect the material, and telling their story, you know, to change people's perceptions of the woods that we use. That's something that I'm really loving doing at the moment. And because it, as well, it's, you know, it's just another what's the expression? It's another layer to the onion skin, you know. It's increasing the perceived value of a material. So that's something that I'm really enjoying, and the relationships that go alongside that as well. So it's how do we look to change people's perceptions, to secure and ensure a sustainable supply of acoustic materials for the future, whilst also borrowing new constructional methods to make the instrument better. So those are the two things. Yeah.
That's awesome. What a cool answer. Thank you. So if people have enjoyed hearing from you, are there any, well, your YouTube channel is the first place they can go, but can you recommend any sort of resources for people to maybe be able to kind of hear or experience the things that you've been describing today?
Yeah, I'm very active on social media. So my Instagram, Tom Sands Guitars, YouTube, I do loads of stuff on YouTube, you know, sound clips, demos of my work.
Cool.
But I also talk about the materials, talk about tools that I use. And as I said, I've just started this new series, Tommy's Tonewoods, where we talk about the materials that I'm using. I do that daily. And also, you know, the website, tomsandsguitars.com.
Amazing. Lots of great resources. I'm very excited to check it out. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me today. It's been fascinating. I could have talked to you for so much longer. and it's, I don't know, it just seems like such a wonderful mixture of musicality and materials and crafting and construction and engineering and all the rest of it. So yeah, keep doing what you're doing, and I'm excited to follow your progress as you go forward and solve those unanswered questions.
Thank you so much for asking me to be on your show.
Pleasure. So that was the awesome Tom Sands on wood. A huge thanks to him for coming on, and definitely check out his YouTube channel where you'll see wood doing some truly extraordinary things. And thanks too to previous guest Rebecca Struthers for introducing me to Tom in the first place. That's everything for this week. As always, it'd be awesome if you could like and subscribe to the podcast so that you don't miss out on any episodes. If you want to support with a one-time financial donation, you can do so at supporter.acast.com/handmade. Thanks a lot to everyone who's already done that, which really does help keep us going. You can say hi to us on social media. We're on Twitter at Real Talk, that's R-I-A-L Talk, and on Instagram at Handmade Pod. Huge thanks as always to Dave Shepherd for our awesome cover art and to Alex Lathbridge for the music mix. Next week, I'll be talking to entrepreneur Meghna Giridhar about promoting artisan crafts from around the world. So until then, take very good care, and I look forward to speaking to you next time on Handmade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.